Welcome to the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast. It's a podcast that amplifies the voices of people around the world with multiple chemical sensitivity, or MCS, also known as environmental illness, chemical intolerance, and toxicant-induced loss of tolerance, or TILT. The podcast also highlights emerging research about the illness. I'm Aaron Goodman, host and founder of the podcast. This is episode 19. The title is Photographing the Canaries. You'll hear documentary photographer Tilde Jensen speak about her 2013 book, The Canaries. It's a compelling collection of self-portraits and photographs of others with MCS. The book has received international acclaim. Tilde's photographs about MCS have been published by the New York Times, Slate, and others, and have been shown in galleries in the U.S. and abroad. Tilde was born in Denmark and moved to New York City in 1997 to work as an editorial and documentary photographer. 6 years later, she developed severe MCS and had to leave the city. For 2 years, she lived in tents and trailers, moving between New York State and Arizona. There, she met and began photographing others like her who were trying to find ways of surviving with MCS. Tilde now lives in a small town in upstate New York in a home she built. In this interview, you'll hear Tilde discuss her reasons for creating the book and photographing herself and others with MCS, her intention to inform people who don't have the illness about the condition, and the approach she took and how some people may view it as controversial. I hope you enjoy the conversation and find it of benefit. We release new episodes twice a month. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to help others learn about the podcast. Follow us on social media. Just search for the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast or Podcasting MCS. Leave your comments about anything you hear on the podcast, and please share the podcast with others. And some exciting news. The podcast is now on YouTube, and you can read the captions in any language you like. Support the podcast and help us continue creating greater awareness about MCS. Please find a link in the episode descriptions at www.chemicalsensitivitypodcast.org. Get in touch anytime. Just email info@chemicalsensitivitypodcast.org. And thanks so much for listening. Well, Tilde Jensen, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me on the podcast.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad to be here.
I wanted to start by asking you, leading up to the point where you chose to create your book, could you talk a little bit about where you were living, what your life was like at that time?
I lived in New York City. I was a photographer. I was married, and I'm from Denmark. So I'd come to New York to study photography and work photography world there, and had been fairly successful. I was starting to work for a lot of magazines at the time, and then I got sick, and I got sick quite fast and got very severe quite fast, and I had to leave New York. I had to start wearing a respirator everywhere I went. My marriage fell apart. My career sort of ended as I couldn't, you know, go on assignments anymore. And I ended up living in a tent sort of in the woods for a time period. And then also in the desert in around Tucson, Arizona, I had managed to gut an Airstream trailer. And I survived in that for two winters down there, and then came back up to upstate New York in the summers to sort of explore and find what has become my permanent home.
It must have been really cold living in a tent in New York State in the winter. And is that what led you to, as you say, get an Airstream and make the journey west to Arizona?
Yeah. Yes, it was. And but also because there's a large group of people in the Southwest, in the desert areas. And I was so severe, so I felt like it would be nice to be around other people and get some guidance and sort of be part of a community, so to speak. And I definitely enjoyed that when I first came there. And unfortunately, the desert environment didn't really quite agree with me. The dustiness of it and the dryness and the vegetation didn't agree with me. So I feel better up here in the northeast. So I do better up here, but I'm not as mold sensitive as some people are. So I can handle a wetter climate better.
And at what point did you decide to start taking photos of people with MCS? And when did the idea to create a book of photographs come to you?
Given that I was a photographer and I ended up with this illness that I just hadn't really heard about before. I'd seen the movie Safe, but when I saw it, I didn't realize that it was a real illness. And it was very disturbing to me, the movie. And so when I realized that this was a real thing and that there wasn't any very, you know, any knowledge in the general population about it, I felt that maybe this was something I could do and help sort of create some imagery that was expressive of. Initially, it was more personal too, because I was alone suddenly all the time. I was sort of isolated and stuck in with mostly myself. And I had the camera, so I started just doing self-portraits to document my own life. And from there on, I realized when I took this one picture that not everybody knows is a self-portrait, but of me in the bathtub with my mask on, because that was an actual thing. I would shower. I had rented a place and the bathroom had just newly been renovated, so with the tile work. And it was sort of a beautiful bathroom, but it was super toxic. So I had to use my respirator when I was showering, which was absurd, obviously. And then I thought, well, I need to document this because this is bizarre. And this is what we're sort of going through. I thought it was very... And then when I saw the picture, I realized that, well, here I actually have something that sort of goes beyond just the mere sort of documentation. This is actually a picture that speaks not just to people who have this, but to the outside world, which was, you know, the people I really wanted to communicate with. And so I continued that, but also didn't really want to be the person being photographed. You know, I did it because I had to, but as soon as I was able to start photographing other people, that's what I did.
I'll post a link to some sites where people listening can check out the images from your book. And of course, people are welcome to purchase signed copies of your book on your website. In the book there, I didn't know that was a self-portrait of you. It's a very compelling image of you, as you describe, standing in the shower with a respirator mask. There's also an image of a young woman showering inside a tent and there's snow outside on the ground. There are also landscape images of the desert where some of the images were taken. How did you choose what kind of images to take? And when it came to inviting people to photograph, what was that process like? How did you find them? Did you spend time with them before photographing them? And was it important for you to have a connection with the people before or during the photographic process?
The picture you mentioned of the woman in the tent showering with snow outside, that's actually my neighbor. And that was both her and my setup when we first moved to this community where we're living. And we didn't have a house and we didn't have any place to shower. So we just shower in this tarp tent, even when it got very cold. In the beginning, the people I was photographing were the people I've sort of met along the way who also shared this illness and this experience, and they were sort of my friends. And from there on, when later on I was able to go back to the desert for two trips, actually, you know, driving across country and using those connections I had already made when I was there, living there for two winters, that network, I would just put the word out that I was photographing for this book. And by then, my work had already been in the New York Times. So that sort of opened a door, because people, this was the first time the New York Times had sort of dealt with this. And they had, not only did they have a slideshow online, but they actually had my text printed which was sort of, you know, a big achievement. So it was basically my words about the illness. So there wasn't this whole questioning whether it was real or not, which was, I don't know why it happened like that, but it did. And it was, I was grateful, of course, for it. But that opened the door within the community of environmental illness for me. People wanted to be part of it because of that, I think. So that's sort of how I worked with the project. I would travel to different locations that I already knew there was people, either that I were my friends or friends of friends. And then from there might be other people I would meet. And that's sort of how it developed. And then I had some people who also contacted me because of the New York Times article and said, if you are ever coming our way to photograph, there's definitely a story here. And one of those were Dennis in Grand Island, Nevada, where there were like a community of sort of more blue collar workers who'd gotten sick from this ammunition plant that had been there, contaminated the soil and the water. And it was sort of not being dealt with. Everybody said it was safe, but it really wasn't. But they were not people who necessarily identified with that they were victims of environmental illness or chemical sensitivities. And he understood that that was what they were dealing with. But the majority of them were just so sick. And even he was living in a household where his daughter was using perfume and, you know, didn't really want to, you know, deal with the fact that her dad was getting sick from that. But that was an important part of the story, I felt, to have them in there.
Do you have a favorite photo from the book?
I have two. Well, it's hard. The one on the cover of Marie, where she's using her phone box. She's a highly electrically sensitive, but also sensitive to light and to sunlight, and chemically sensitive, of course. And so she can only use her phone once a week for an hour, and it has to be outside where she can sit with, you know, grounded, her feet grounded in the grass or in the soil. And then she's under this umbrella and using a specialized phone. And I mean, when you look at it, it's a beautiful image. You don't understand that, well, what I just explained, but I think it for me, it still captures, there's something strange about the image. And then obviously the picture of Greg in the red car, I think, is another one that I really love. And that just sort of just happened. A lot of the other pictures, I would spend time with people and things would happen. And I would say, well, could we take a picture of that? And then we would sort of redo it. Or they would tell me about something. I said, well, could we recreate that setup or go back to that scene, or so to speak, and we would sort of work and through it, and they would show me what, you know, they would do or how they would react, or, you know, like. But this picture of Greg in the red car, where he would sleep and he would wake up early in the morning, and then he was also electrically sensitive, so being on the phone was best for him early in the morning because it got him sort of wired, so he didn't want to do it at night. And then he would hold, and he was one of the people who were also touch sensitive, so he would have gloves on, and then he would hold the handle of the phone away from his ear so not to get so fried. And I sort of just woke up to that picture in the beautiful early morning light and took it. And he was, of course, fine with it. He was aware I took the picture, but it was one of those moments where it just happened right in front of me. And, you know, I think it's a stunning picture and a very weird picture, and definitely one that has, I think, for the outside viewer, it invites people in to our story.
There are a lot of images of people who use aluminum foil, for example, on the walls of their homes to make them safer, to seal in toxins. I wonder how you view the use of tinfoil, and you also wrap the book in tinfoil before you send it. When I bought a copy of the book, it came wrapped in tinfoil. And as the photographer and creator, what was your intention in photographing people's different uses of aluminum foil? And were you hoping that people who purchase the book and handle it have an experience related to the tinfoil, whether they have MCS or not?
Yeah, so I think I need to say maybe right away that my main audience, the people I was trying to reach with this book, was not the people who already have experience with this illness, but the people who don't. So I knew that I had to, you know, both show things that were part of the illness that was different, of course. I mean, I had a lot of, and I think this brings up maybe another question, but I had people in the EI community who desperately wanted someone, and maybe me, but definitely someone to take just really normal, happy portraits of people with this illness. And I'm not saying that there isn't a need for that. I'm just saying that wasn't what I can do. Also, that wasn't, if we were to reach an audience outside of our own group, the pictures had to deal with how our lives are totally different now because of this illness. And we're not normal anymore. So obviously, many of the people I came in contact with who are severe had to somehow modify their building situation. And aluminum foil is one of the cheap sort of barriers to use to encapsulate something that's problematic, outgassing chemicals, or to create a barrier, a shelter from the outside world. And it probably has a little bit of effect for the people who are electrically sensitive, but mainly it's for chemicals. So when I was in the design process of the book, I knew I wanted it to be a work of art. And I also knew that I wanted to give the outside viewer the experience of a tactical, because I mean, the illness is so tactical. I mean, there is so much physicality in it that I wanted the viewer who wasn't familiar with our world to get a little piece of that. And I thought wrapping the book, which is something that people who live in their cars and have books or things that are problematic, maybe outgassing stuff, but still want to have it in their little safe space, they do wrap books in aluminum foil. So I thought this was a good way of sort of presenting that and giving the outside viewer the experience of being in our world.
There are some paper inserts in the book, I believe four, and these are text-based messages that are written by people with MCS. There's one written by a 45-year-old woman in Massachusetts in the United States with deteriorating health caused by MCS. And she writes, quote, "The bane of my existence is that my tongue swells and my throat closes off. Everything I touch bothers me, polyesters, material, you name it. I cannot even tolerate 100% cotton futon very well, including smells, fumes, inks. I have nowhere to sleep, sit, etc. I lost my job too, and I feel my life. I'm crying as I write to you." And she ends the note with, "I know this is all a crazy email, but I have to hurry. Too much to say. Please respond if you can." And it's an urgent plea, and it reflects the fear that I believe many of us with severe MCS experience and the isolation. And these are all themes that emerge through your photography, would you say?
And I mean, this is a real email that I've received, unfortunately, a fair amount of these kinds of emails after the New York Times article and other articles. This was one of those emails, and I get very emotional when you read that, because it was such a sad situation, and I couldn't help her, but I asked her if I could use that email because I thought, well, this is important to share. And she was fine with that. So yeah, that's part of one of the texts in the book. Some of the other texts are also, you know, about some very tough stories, people being very, very stuck with this and very, very sick.
They are very compelling to read and very distressing. And as I read them, I felt like they're not unlike a lot of posts that people with MCS post online in groups for people with the illness. And I wonder, do you think the situation for people with MCS has gotten any better since you created the book? People are still facing very urgent, critical situations and are often very desperate for help. But do you feel that through work like your own and through more discussions and awareness that people feel less isolated, or does the sense of isolation and fear still exist for folks?
I think it's probably both, but I do think that from the time I got sick to today, there is so many more options available. There are all these forums so that you have the ability to communicate with other people and get ideas to what you might do or help, or someone might guide you in a direction to find safe housing or, you know, a doctor to see. Or so in that way, I think that it's easier. That doesn't mean that there is very much safe housing, or that, unfortunately, I think a lot of the treatments are so individual. Some of them help some of us, and some of them, you know, are just a lot of waste of time and money. But I do think being able to socialize is important initially when you first get sick. It's very crucial. And I got sick right when the internet was becoming a thing. So I was very fortunate with that I was able to use the internet at first, and then I became electrically sensitive, so I couldn't. But I was able to do a lot of research, and the only stories, I printed out any story I could find where people had gotten better, and it was only about 4 stories, and I did everything they had done. And that wasn't necessarily what helped me, but it did sort of narrow it down to that the things that were important was diet, exercise, avoidance, housing, some very specific things. And not having the internet, which, you know, the generation before me didn't, would just make it much harder to get better. Whereas I think today, you know, at least maybe there's too much information out there, and there's too many directions that people get thrown in, and a lot of them being a waste of time and money maybe. But at least I feel that there is more information out there, and there is a sense that you're not alone going through this. And there is, I hope that with my work, you know, being out there and being available through so many, it's been, you know, the New York Times, Slate, Wired, there's so many different news outlets have shown my work, that it's easy for someone to find a link and show it to their relatives or to, you know, and say, hey, I'm not, you know, the only one, you know, like this is the real thing. And I hope that's helpful. I don't know, but I definitely have gotten a lot of emails and thank yous for doing that from people. I hope that it has helped at least some people.
Because so many people with chemical sensitivity are still misdiagnosed, and we do face a lot of stigma and misunderstanding. You know, we're often told we have anxiety disorders, etc. We're not believed. We're dismissed by clinicians, by family, by coworkers. And you mentioned that part of your intention was to reach a wider audience, people who don't have the illness, to create awareness. And I wanted to ask, you know, in terms of your process and your thinking around how you chose to represent people with MCS. To my eye, and I think you noted, they do look like they live outside of the norm, right? They don't look like they live in quote unquote normal society. And I wanted to ask, is there a risk that your images could possibly contribute to a misunderstanding of people with MCS, or people might look at the images and see people in the images as others or outcasts? I know that's not your intention, but is that something you think about, you thought about in terms of how you wanted to represent people?
I definitely thought about all of that, but given that I was one of the both people photographed, but also having gone through the experience myself and at the severe end of it, I knew that if I was going to tell this story, I could only tell the story from both my personal experience. I had to be truthful about that. And also that it's very hard to take pictures of people who look totally normal and have that be a good picture of that represents the illness, even if that person is suffering from the illness and dealing with it on a daily basis. As a photographer, I can't convey that in an image if there's nothing in that visual that tells me, gives me the clues to that. So I wanted to tell the story with imagery. I didn't want it to be, I'm not a photojournalist. I'm a photographer slash artist, and my sort of initial inspiration growing up was expressionistic painting, like Edvard Munch, The Scream, and also cinematography, like Ingmar Bergman's sort of melancholic psychological cinematography. So that's sort of where I'm coming from. And my interest as a photographer is in the experience of being alive and the expression of that. And I'm not someone who myself is so afraid of not appearing normal. And I was quite aware that when I got sick with this illness, that my life had turned into a surreal sort of nightmare, and it was absolutely freakish and bizarre at times. And I felt that it was be untrue to the story, and it wouldn't also make it very interesting to the outside viewer if I was sort of trying to pare that down for us to not to look different, if I was sort of censoring in a sense. But that being said, of course, yeah, the people who are in the book represent the people who are generally quite severe. And there is probably many other stories that needs to be told, but the kind of photography that I'm good at or have become good at wouldn't allow for that kind of storytelling. That's just not me. So I did what I'm good at, which is, I think, to dive in to where it gets difficult, but also doing it in a way that's both provocative, maybe, but beautiful. And so I think there is a sense of beauty in my light, my colors, and the way I compose. And there's a lot of references, I think, in my pictures, whether they're deliberate or not, but to sort of fairy tale and to art and things. So there is a lot of ways for the outside viewer to come into this sort of nightmarish world of illness, which normally people don't want to, you know, I know we've just lived through a pandemic, but normally people don't want to deal with illness at all. So that was sort of the artistic challenge for me, was to present this horrific, painful journey that I had gone through and so many other people around me was going through in a way that was appealing to the outside world. Can you say that there is some element of freakish behavior in some of my pictures? For sure. But I think that they were all real elements to our lives going through this. And I think now that it's become so normalized to wear masks, that's no longer a freakish thing. But of course, back in the day when I took the pictures and I was going through it wearing a mask and being the only one in the supermarket, you felt like a freak. And so I felt like it was valid to have that feeling in the images too. And of course, if people want to use that as a way to say, oh, look at this, you know, you look like a freak, you can always do that. But I don't think that not showing it would also be a disservice, I think. But that's my take as a photographer, and that's also my most current work about homelessness in general, not EI homelessness, also sort of deals with some of these issues. It's like, I want to show the reality that I'm being presented with, and I don't want to censor it. And that sometimes can be very provocative, and in our very sort of political correct world, sometimes you end up stepping into territory that's maybe a little bit difficult, complicated. But I feel that if the people I'm photographing is okay with it, and if they feel that it is truthful to their reality and their experience, then I'm not doing something wrong. It might be uncomfortable for the viewer to have to deal with a reality that hasn't been sort of put together in a way that we would like it to be. But there is also, if everything is packaged in a certain way to fit our political correctness of how we would like the reality to be, we are no longer looking at reality. And I think that's sort of, so yeah, maybe there is this, you know, my work probably is a little bit provocative, and not everybody likes it, for sure. Not, there's definitely people in the EI world who has issues with it because of that. They feel like it's over-dramatized and things, and that's okay. I mean, it's totally fine if people don't like it. But I think that it's, for me, it's more important that there is a reaction, that there is a dialogue, and that we get seen. And I think that's sometimes you have to, I mean, a painter like Edvard Munch's The Scream, I mean, in today's world, maybe, you know, that seems, you know, like anything that deals with human suffering, it can be difficult. And it sort of goes past some of the boundaries that we have created that we don't want these uncomfortable feelings or entering into our private sphere.
Well, thank you so much for talking about that. It's very helpful. Yeah. How have people whom you photographed responded?
Well, I think everybody that was in the book who have seen it, which is most, really like it. I feel like I, you know, have done their story justice and my own. So I feel good about the work. And it has been received, you know, tremendously well also in the outside world, where it's got a lot of attention. I mean, granted, there's the whole, of course, always the discussion of the controversy around it. But it has also been accepted into the collection at the Museum of Modern Art, both in New York and in San Francisco. And it is one of the books that are now taught around the universities around the United States. And not because of the chemical sensitivity part, but photography students are taught or are attracted to this body of work because it has an autobiographical element to it. And maybe because it's feminine in some, the beauty aspect to it and is different than books before, really having to do with chemical sensitivity or environmental illness, but in how we deal with other kind of illnesses or issues, you know, emotional issues or things like that, how we can deal with that as photographers and artists.
Another perhaps difficult or challenging question. There have been some people who've noted that, and you could please tell me if I'm right, that all of the people whom you photographed are white in the book. And we know that many racialized and underserved communities in North America and beyond, including communities where Black people and Indigenous people are the majorities and live, are frequently close to toxic pollution. And these communities are often impacted because they often don't have the financial means to leave these communities in search of less toxic refuges. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on that, because we know that not everyone who has environmental illness is white.
My neighbor, who's in the book and who's the one in the outside tub or with the snow, she's half Thai. So, I mean, not everybody's 100% white, but it's the people I have been in contact with when I got sick, and this might have changed. You know, I got sick about almost 20 years ago. At that time, it was predominantly white. It was one person that I came across who was African-American, but she wasn't very sensitive. And that's not to say that, as you say, that there aren't many different areas around the United States where people have definitely been exposed to toxins and probably have developed chemical sensitivities. I didn't come across it. Could I have searched better for it? Maybe. Through this project, you know, was limited both financially, but also by my own illness. And again, going back in time, you know, there wasn't as much, I mean, I couldn't use a computer for many years there. And even before that, I mean, it just wasn't, I mean, we're so used to there being all these ways of doing research today through the internet that just wasn't quite as available back then. If I'd known about, you know, any groups like that or locales like that, I would definitely have gone. And that's why I went out of my way to go to Nebraska, where there was this group of more like blue collar workers who had gotten sick, but who didn't identify as much as with, you know, the environmental illness part of it. But they definitely had it. But they also had a lot of other things and they were dying from it. There is also, and I don't know whether there is a genetic factor. I mean, I know that Sherry Rogers, the doctor who was sort of early on, she actually grew up right here where I live in this area and practice up here near Syracuse. And she was surprised at some point. She noticed that all of her patients were all sort of blondish, blue-eyed, and whether there was a genetic factor there. And again, maybe that has more to do with privilege, economics, or maybe there is a genetic factor. I don't know. But it definitely, the reality I was seeing in the EI community as I was traveling around and also since have been that it is, for some strange reason, predominantly sort of more white. So that's what the book reflects. I mean, I wasn't trying to, I could have gone after the one or two people I met that didn't fit that, and make sure to include them in the book to have a better representation. But if the pictures were, I let the, whether I had a good picture be the reason for being in the book, not whether they represented a certain minority group. If I were to do the book today, maybe it would be different, because maybe the landscape is different today that I don't even know, because I'm not really on the forums anymore. It probably would be a different book, I would imagine.
Thank you so much. Perhaps a last question. You titled the book The Canaries. Why did that feel like the right title for the book?
At the time, again, it was very much the way people identified with the illness, that we were the canaries in the coal mine. And so initially it was just called Canaries, and then it seemed stronger if it was the Canaries. So that changed. But it also felt like, again, to the outside viewer, as maybe a title that would make them think. So it sort of just stuck that was the right title for me. And it's a beautiful bird, of course.
Well, Tilda, thank you so much for taking time to speak on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you, Aaron, for inviting me on.
That brings us to the end of this episode of the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast. Thank you very much to Tilda Jensen for speaking with me. The podcast is produced by me, Aaron Goodman, Rainey Novak, and Christy Eklund. We release new episodes twice a month. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to help others find the podcast. Follow us on social media. Just search for the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast or Podcasting MCS. Leave your comments about anything you hear on the podcast, and please share the podcast with others. And some exciting news, the podcast is available on YouTube, where you can read captions in any language you like. Support the podcast and help us continue creating greater awareness about MCS. Find a link in the episode descriptions at chemicalsensitivitypodcast.org. And if there's someone you'd like to hear interviewed on the podcast or a topic you'd like us to explore, just let me know. Email me at info@chemicalsensitivitypodcast.org. And thanks so much for listening.